Right.
Well, welcome to the Rough Finance. Hello. Aren't you the brave ones, picking the brand new course that no one's ever done before and no one's ever taught before?
Yes, how exciting. Brave ones indeed. Be brave then, for your captain is brave and vows reformation. There shall be 7 halfpenny buns sold for a score. It shall be a felony to drink small beer, and all the realms shall be held in common. When I am king, for king I will be. But the first thing we do, let's kill all the lawyers. Henry VI, part two. Cade coming back to England, deciding he's going to be king, going to usurp the crown, and a basic communist message. Let's kill all the lawyers is the kind of thing, however, you hear from financiers and bankers. Okay? If you think bankers are the lowest of the low in the public generally, the suspicion you certainly used to get within banking about lawyers was much the same. You were just seen as a troublemaker. You were just seen as someone that was, for reasons entirely of your own, creating problems. The lawyer's role was to say, oh, no, you can't do that, because. Part of the reason I wanted to teach the law of finance is that I wanted to teach the law of finance. I wanted to help us all create the law of finance, because it doesn't actually exist. Okay? It doesn't exist. There is no real such field. We have finally got an area of law called the law of finance. You know, for the first time, we've finally got a book. We decided to sit down and write the text, so there wasn't one, literally filling a gap in the market. So what we're trying to do is to make it. Okay? Looking at the financial crisis that's been going on since August 2007, we've seen there's a need for systemic reform of financial regulation. Definitely, definitely, definitely. Capitalism broke down. If it hadn't been for government stepping in to save those banks, really, the way we've done capitalism since the early 1990s was just finished. Yeah. If all those banks had gone bankrupt, that really was the end of it all. So we need to think about how does this law work. Now, reassuringly for all of you, my method for doing this involves fusing financial regulation and all that stuff, which will be new to you, with law you already know. Okay? Contract law, tort law, property law, a bit of judicial review if we wanted, yeah, fiduciary law, some equity, all stuff with which you are already familiar. It's the same law that financiers need to worry about. Just, there is a big act called the Financial Services and Markets Act 2000, which gives lots of powers to the Financial Services Authority, and that's the new bit. So our method through this year is just going to be to marry one with the other. So actually it's going to be much less scary than we might otherwise have. Cough, terrible cough. Oranges, we can't afford to be ill. Right, so if you were allowed a handout, it would look like this. Oh, how exciting. Teaching and learning method, good lord. I don't care if they're wireless networks, do I? It's the first time in the UK that you can study this, okay, at undergraduate level. And I think even most of the postgraduate courses tend to be very superficial and talking generalities. We're going to make it a legal subject, okay? Two things are going on, as far as I'm concerned. Some of you will have picked this course because you want to go out in the world and be finance lawyers and be rich. Yes, you feel the lure of the Maserati. Some people nodding furiously. Fair enough. Some of you would have picked it because you've no idea what else to do. Some of you have picked it because you thought, well, equity interest didn't kill me, so maybe this one will be all right. I'm trying to do two things at once, really. I am trying to teach you the law of finance. Okay, this is an educational mission for me, as far as I'm concerned. And for those of you that just want to study it sociologically and think, how does the system work? What on earth has gone wrong with the financial markets in the last few years? That looks interesting. Let's study that. For those of you who want to go and get a job with Alan Overy, Clifford Chance, whoever it may be, and want to practice finance law, then I just want to explain to you the perimeter of everything you really need to know to be a finance lawyer, yeah, and make you uniquely well qualified to do all that. The second thing that's going on is preparing you for an exam. I know 95% of the email traffic I've had with you over the summer has been, there's no exam paper, and what on earth will we do? And help, and will it all be all right? Will I get to one? Will I get a job? yes, it'll all be fine. If you had your handouts with you, you see, all of this would have been explained to you, but you haven't. Can I just apologise for that again? Did I apologise before? I'm sorry. I have no idea what's going wrong there. Apparently they're in the middle of being copied or something. I don't understand why that is. So, you have, let me just explain, lecture course documents, which will cover everything that we go through in this room. Okay, I'll do all the lectures. You have a lot of material in here. It seems forbiddingly long and full of stuff, because there is no such thing as the cases of material to think of this for. So I thought I need to try and give you all the stuff that you need. You're not allowed on Blackboard either, are you? Did we run a university? Have we ever done this before? I'm trying to put lots of stuff on Blackboard, although it's all disappeared, so nice Amanda's trying to help me find it again. My plan is to put as much as I possibly can on there, obscure cases, links to all kinds of websites and whatever else in there as well. There's actually loads of stuff, so I'm just trying to give you as much stuff as I can and lead you through the lectures. Lots of bullet points, so again, you'll know what I'm talking about, you'll have it down there in front of you. At the back of the course documents, at the top here, you also have specimen exam paper. I have drafted you what a previous year's exam paper would have looked like had there been. Okay. Also in the seminar material, so that's got, well, let's just say, that's open book. I'll explain open book in a second. Answer any three questions. As I see it at the minute, that involves 10 questions in total. 10's a choice of essay titles, 9's a problem, 8's a problem, 7's a problem, 6's a problem, 5's a problem or an essay, 4's a problem, 3's a problem or an essay, 1 and 2 are both essays. So you can just do essays, you can just do problems or any combination you like of those, okay? The idea is to give you as much scope and latitude for that as possible. In the seminar materials, I've also identified with an asterisk questions which I think could have been in exam papers. Okay? So again, to give you an idea when you're preparing seminars, the sorts of things that could have been in the exam. So in terms of preparing you for an examination and getting as many of you as possible, at least over the 60 line, yes, we're doing a lot of that. I'm doing the lectures. Magdalena Latek is doing all the seminars. I said this in the option talk months and months ago, but I don't think everyone was there. It just seemed fairer. A little pressure on me just to do lots of trust seminars, fair enough. But also it seemed fairer that everyone had the same seminar leader rather than having some with one and some with another, because I wouldn't have been allowed to do all those hours, apparently. Magda's brilliant. Magda and I have known each other for a long time. She's a good mate of mine. And finance law is one of her, well, is her key research field. I mean, that's where she and I are working together a lot going forward, as they say. So Magda's a great person to do that with, and she's lovely. She's very good. She's very nice. One of the key messages for seminars, and I stress this to Magda, to rein in her better self, is that anyone that isn't prepared gets strangled. Is that she doesn't need to talk very much in seminars. Okay, it's, the onus is on you. We are making this subject. Okay, so there are lots of problems to answer wherever else, but a lot of the answers nobody knows, genuinely. And there are lots of problems in finance law, very, very little decided case law, compared to trust, compared to tort and whatever else, simply because that's the way it is. Banks don't like to go to court. They prefer to settle. So a lot of what we're doing is asking you to think back to the contract law you've studied, the tort law you've studied, the property law you've studied. What do you think the answer would be? So her mission has been to encourage you and let you talk as much as possible, let you discuss and get around these issues. I think your seminars will be a lot of fun. And I'm going to do a lot of how we answer a problem kind of stuff in lectures as well. So you're going to be fine in terms of the how am I going to get a 60 from all of this kind of process. Let's go back to what's on the screen. Aims and objectives, you can read all this for yourself. Come on. Come along, little computer. New friend. The computer's not fully protected. Well, look at Lehman Brothers. No one's protected. Learning outcomes. We want you to have a knowledge of financial regulation, knowledge of the relevant principles of English and EU law, an analytical understanding of the principal issues relating to the legal analysis of financial markets, and a critical understanding of the social impact of financial law and regulation. So whether you're an enthusiast just because you want to know about money and law and how it works, if you've come here with a kind of sociological, theoretical interest in it, this course is intended to give you lots of scope to go to whichever direction you like. And it may be that as you go through your seminars, Magda and I decide that actually the exam paper needs to change slightly and you've really got off on some things more than we expected and less on other things than we expected. Then I'm going to let you know in here and the assessment will reflect what we've studied on and what's really called on. The fun thing about doing an option is we kind of become a gang and get to do our thing. Yeah, fun. We can do whatever we like. We just don't tell anybody. And the idea is that you apply your knowledge, answer problems, and put essays together and whatever else. there is potentially a lot of stuff in this course, and what I wanted to do was to enable you to do as much reading to take this wherever you want to go. And so this is an open book course. Let me explain a little bit about that. That means in the exam you can take anything into the exam room you like. Okay? You can take in anything that's not electronically stored. You'd be ashamed for laptop bunnies. But you can take in textbook, notes, print-offs from things you found on the internet. Please, not too upset. Taking anything you like into the exam room with you. The intention is to reward kind of consistent and hard work across the year. So instead of it being a memory test like an ordinary closed book exam, instead of just giving you the handout like we did in Law Property 2 last year, the intention is that you can take in absolutely anything. So if you've prepared an essay, thought something through and planned how you're going to be able to write it out in an hour and you hope it's going to come up because it sounds like it probably will, you can take that in with you. That's just rewarding your hard work. For me, it's deconstructing slightly the whole exam thing. What you must not do, I would suggest, I really cannot urge this on you too much, is to rely entirely on your notes, particularly if you're going to do problem questions. Where open book can go wrong is if you rely on the fact that it's there in your big lever arch file somewhere, but it's not in your brain necessarily. Okay? You can't possibly do well in problem answers, for example, unless you know the law enough to spot the issue that's come up in the problem in front of you. So having it all in your beautiful notes but not in your brain is useless in an open book exam. You have to know it as though it was closed book. Yeah. Seriously, you only have to know your stuff as though it was a closed book exam. Everything else is just there with you, whether they're flow charts, essay plans, amateur, whatever, to jog your memory, stop you panicking about forgetting it all or whatever else. You really do need to know your stuff. Obviously, you can't do a problem question afterwards. And if the essay title doesn't come up quite the way you want, you need to be able to think, how am I going to write an essay using the material I've prepared? So otherwise, if you rely on it being in your lever arch file and not in your brain, that's where open book exams can go wrong. Otherwise, it's difficult to see how they could. Okay? You organise the stuff in whatever way works for you. That's the idea. Okay? Hence, open book. So that's our plan. Resources. Oh, God, resources. You haven't got any. You're not even allowed to have a handout, apparently. Sorry. Suggestion of how to go about your study. Yes, jolly good. Suggestion of how to go about your study. Same kind of message as last year with Property 2, really. I suggest having a bit of a read in advance of the lecture. Okay, that way, what goes on in the lecture will make a lot more sense. I only finished writing this book really in January, so it's not a huge surprise to anyone that thought I could say things that are vaguely similar to what's in the book. Have a read in advance. What I have sought to do, very like that book from last year, pretty, isn't it? We'll talk about how pretty it is in just a second, because I'm very excited about how pretty it is. And we'll also talk about my death, which some of you might say is fun. Switch on. Where does that come up? Never mind. It starts with a nice little index to each individual chapter at the beginning. Now, because this is a huge book, yeah? It's a huge book. It's 1,400 pages long. And it's brilliant. Yes? Obviously. The car chase about two-thirds of the way through is just thrilling. It's like Bullet. If you haven't seen Bullet, that doesn't mean anything. So, we're not expecting you to learn and know all of a 1,400-page book. Not even I am that mean. Each of the seminar materials... This is why I want the document camera to come up, and apparently it's going to. Will it? Anywhere? No? I press document camera on here. Swine thing. There's a table at the front which tells you exactly which paragraphs within the reading you're expected to look at. So rather than having to read the whole of lots and lots of very long chapters, I don't know how many of your textbook you come across this done, each individual paragraph is numbered. So it's very, very specific about what you're expected to know. You go on and read anything you want to read, above and beyond and around that, but that's kind of what you're being tested on. So whereas I aim to teach you about a lot more than is in the seminars, okay, we really are trying to be very specific about what you're expected to be tested on to kind of limit how much reading is expected to be on those sorts of things. Each chapter at the beginning also has a statement of the core principles. So pretty much like my other book, some of them are just a paragraph long, some of them are a page and a half. At least have a look at that for the lecture and have a vague idea of what's going on. It'll help you get your notes together so much more efficiently and know what it is we're focusing on. particularly if we're focusing on aspects of the chapter, if you just then start making notes on all of it, you're going to be doing far more than you necessarily need. So that's the goal there.
This document camera doesn't want to work. Let me tell you something about my death. Sweet and Maxwell are predicting it. The book, there is only one. God, it's heavy. It's called Hudson, The Law of Finance, first edition by Alastair Hudson, oddly. What's going on there is Sweet and Maxwell are saying, this is in part of their classic series. I am so pleased about this. I'm just going to bang on for just a second. When I was 18, I went into Hammock Sweet and Maxwell, as the bookshop was called, on Chancery Lane. And a couple of us stood there, like, estimated university, and said, God, I'd love to buy one. Isn't it beautiful? Look at these beautiful books. They're lovely classical paintings. Look, me! My mum's delighted. So I'm very, very pleased by all of this. But the Hudson Law of Finance means this will become Hudson's Law of Finance. So when I'm dead, some overweight, bloated, boorish professor of who knows what at the University of Oxford will become the next editor of Hudson's Law of Finance. You know, will presumably change its political bent entirely and probably make it a much better book. So Sweet Maxwell are basically waiting for me to die. So that's nice to know. The picture, I was very pleased about finding this. The picture is by George Elgar Hicks, pasted in about 1846. It's called Dividend Day at the Bank of England. And it really encapsulates for me a lot of what I like about some types of art and kind of Dickensian novels and those kind of things. And also a lot about finance. Finance, everyone assumes, is very modern and very now and changes minute by minute and hour by hour. And if you go into practice finance, you will find that is the general expectation. A lot of what you'll be advising on is something new and exciting. And today we've got a new product. Yeah, we're going to destroy the world with this thing there. And so you'll be tending to spend your time looking at standard market documentation or standard market analyses of how certain issues work and don't work. And it's very easy to forget that actually there is a lot of law out there and a lot of history. So what I like about this painting is it shows very lower middle class English Victorian people queuing up at the Bank of England. Because clearly these people, there's one of them in a bath chair, you can tell by their clothes, aren't of the haute bourgeoisie, bless. And this is clearly all of their money. All of their money is invested in the Bank of England. And so this is dividend day. This is when the Bank of England pays them the annual amount of interest they're entitled to because they hold Bank of England bonds. And they're queuing up slightly desperate. Long queue, they've brought their dogs, the whole family's come because this is the day they get their money. Okay? I love this, I like the painting itself, but I love the idea that we're looking at finance not just at the corporate level, we're also going to think about the human level at the other end. We're going to think about how the law and how financial regulation deals with big financial institutions, big banks and their traders on the one hand, and how it deals with ordinary investors, private individuals, pension funds and so on the other. Because it's protecting that second class of people, what bankers tend to refer to as widows and orphans, rather oddly. It's protecting those people that most financial regulation is aimed at. That's really what the focus is. How do we stop those people suffering loss? Okay. And that's been the great problem, of course, over the last year and a half, is that the system just fails to do that in a spectacular way. So it's important to understand those two things. It's important to understand as well that there is law and there is history. And there are ideas, and there is nothing new. The securitisation products that have brought down the banking system, the credit default swaps and all those kind of things, the securitisation idea is very, very old. It was known as debt factoring to these Victorians. They did exactly the same thing. They sold off bundles of debts. In exactly the same way securitisations work. So we're giving it a new name, and the maths has got a bit more complicated, so we've got computers. Yes? We've got computers, and therefore we're brilliant. So there is a history. There are ideas there already. And one of the scholarly, intellectual tasks is to think, how do these old ideas, all this old law, you know, what can we get from them and how do they work in the modern context? So we're going to spend a lot of time, for example, looking at very modern regulation on securities issues and prospectuses. And we're going to look at Capara and Dickman and all those cases that you know very well from common law too, and think, how do all those criticisms about negligence and misstatement apply in a context in which you're obliged by the regulation to make certain information available to the entire public, whether you want to or not. Actually, Capara and Dickman, as far as finance law is concerned, doesn't matter anymore. Yeah, the regulation has just whizzed past the House of Lords decision. So looking at whether Capara and Dickman matters anymore, how to possibly apply in a modern context, is one of the things we're looking at. So it's going to be a lot of that kind of fun, comparing things you've already done. Now, I'm starting to use words like securities, trading, debt factory, securitization. You're already going to think, oh my God, what on earth is going on now?
Don't worry. You don't need to know all about finance to study finance law. Sarcastically, you might think there are lots of very well-paid finance lawyers who don't know anything about finance.
Okay. We are going to start, and we're going to work our way calmly through the financial regulation in particular. And learning about that regulation and how that works will introduce us into all the various financial products. Okay.
So when we get into the swing of it, and you have handouts, I'm going to start at the end of each lecture basically doing a quick vocab session introducing you to some of the key products. So don't worry, nothing to get panicky about. I'm going to explain all this stuff as we go through. Where's the syllabus? I'm asking you. The syllabus here, you see, that's worked well, didn't it? Sources of finance law, we're going to talk about sources first, possibly tomorrow. Then look at the detail of financial regulation, the emotion. So, how that works at the EU level, don't worry. Nick Bernard said to me, don't mention the EU, although eyes will glaze over and they'll all look really panicky. UK financial regulation, which builds off the EU, things like market abuse, insider dealing and so on, we're going to look at in detail. Conduct of business regulation will be absolutely key. This is how do we make sure banks and other financial institutions are treating their customers properly. Okay? So we'll look at that in detail, the so-called conduct of business source book. And we're going to mash that together with bits of contract law in particular and say, in making a contract now in this context, how is the law of an acceptance altered? Right? So those kind of things. Law you already know, all that contract law stuff. We're going to revisit the basic principles and put it in this new context. Some essay-type themes on the overlap between private law and financial regulation. We're going to look at financial crime. So criminal law you've already done. We're then going to look specifically at insider dealing and in detail at money laundering. Which is kind of in the background of all kinds of things you've probably done in criminal law, theft and what have you, and behind when we did tracing, for example, last year. Contract law. Creation of contracts, so-called master agreement structures, which is what most finance lawyers spend most of their lives doing in practice. We're going to look at those. Look at loan contracts and fund things called syndicated lending, when lots of banks mob together and provide loans en masse. And termination of financial contracts and remedies. We shall look at things like rescission, damages, and all the kind of things you have studied. Did you do damages in detail when you did contract law, for example, rescission and those kind of things? Yeah, okay, so we're going to revisit some of that and think how that applies here. We're going to look at how some of the standard market contracts provide for termination and how they try and build their own remedies in as well, so you can compare and contrast what you've done in contract law. Brilliant. And talk. Lending transactions we're going to look at, ordinary lending, syndicated lending, and bonds. So you're going to learn how all these work in detail. Securities regulation, which is offering securities like shares, bonds, derivatives, all kinds of things to the public. Okay. That's heavily regulated, an important part of practice. So you have to prepare prospectuses for that. We're going to look at that. Transparency obligations, all the information you have to make available when you do this. Listing of securities on the stock exchange and liabilities if, when you issue, for example, you make a misrepresentation. Okay. There are particular statutory remedies we're going to look at as well as the case law. We're going to compare and contrast those. We're going to look at tort law, we're going to look at the tort of deceit. I don't think you did fraud, did you, when you did tort? Brilliant, we get to do a new tort. Fun, yeah? As well as doing negligence. Don't worry, we're not going to spend a semester on it. It's all right, breathe easy. Application of tort law to takeovers and issues of securities, so like Caparo and Dickman. Think about how it works under the modern regulation. And FSMA, which is the big act, the Financial Services Markets Act, specific liabilities for wrongs, because the act creates a lot of liabilities itself. We'll look at breach of fiduciary duty. We're going to look at dishonest assistance, unconscionable receipt. Remember these from last year? Please say you remember some of it. Proprietary liabilities, tracing, we'll look at those kind of things again. Okay? And we're going to add on those things to that whole debate, for example, about the Royal Brunei and the town between Sector and Yardley, all that stuff. And then we're going to say, okay, what does it mean to be dishonest? Is it objective or subjective? What if there's also a regulation there that says you're required to do certain things? If money laundering regulation requires you to do a certain thing, conduct of business regulation requires you to take a particular action, what does that do for us when we start trying to say, is this person being honest or dishonest? There's a whole context there that this brings to things we already know. We're going to look at banking law, traditional banking law, taking deposits, checkbooks, all that kind of good old school stuff. When people talk about banking law, they often mean just that, really old-fashioned stuff. But some fascinating law in there, the bank-customer relationship, when is it fiduciary, when is it not? some really fun old 19th century cases about people paying cheques in and when they can take their money out. Payment systems, principles of banking regulation, i.e. the crash. How do we regulate now? How should we regulate in the future? If there's not an essay on an exam paper in this kind of area on that, then I think we all need to go home. I can't believe some of you haven't written that down. The tripartite regulatory structure for banking regulation, the Banking Act 2009, and the legal context of the financial crisis. When the book was published, I made the publishers wait and wait and wait and wait and wait, because I was waiting for the Banking Bill 2008 to become the Banking Act 2009. They eventually said, "Press print, Alistair, we can't wait any longer." A book this size takes them at least as long as it took me to write it, apparently, to print out and glue together. So it's become an act. So the book talks about the bill. I have, however, this is a long story, I have to do a practitioner edition of this book, basically. The idea was then to put a hard copy around that and sell it to other people who didn't realise it was the same thing. Fair enough. If you want to. Libraries might buy it, firms, libraries might buy it, you know, whatever. However, they then decided, you know, they want me to write another book. I said, 1,400 pages, you know how long it takes to type, let alone to think out that? So I said, no. I said another word. But I also said no. So there's a hard copy version like coming out. I just handed it in last night, in fact. So I've done an updated bit of text on the Banking Act and things that have happened since the book. This is what financial markets are like. There's been a whole new act since the book was published. There have been two new EU directives published to deal with hedge funds and all kinds of fun things like that. So there's a lot of stuff I'm going to be putting on my site and on Blackboard for you as we go through the year. There's a lot of fun stuff that keeps happening. And we're going to keep tying that into the issues that are the main bit of the course. What I'm saying is there are lots of these kind of issues and areas where you're going to be able to go yourself. When you look at the specimen exam paper, you'll see the questions are deliberately broad enough to enable you within that particular field to follow whichever bit you find the most interesting. And then I'm going to let you on derivatives at the end. There just wasn't space enough in the course to fit in everything. But I think if I left out derivatives, that would be to leave a gap in your education. So I'm going to cover it in lectures. My dream is that I will organise some kind of seminar for anyone that cares, for anyone that wants to talk about that afterwards, and we'll see how many do or don't by the time we get to March. We'll just see how that one goes. So I'll lecture all that kind of stuff as part of your education, and we can talk about that as well. Okay? I write a lot of derivatives, I like it, but it's complex stuff. But if I missed it out, I think that would be a real shame. So that is the coverage of the course. Okay? I think that gives you all the basics you need to know about finance, or tells you where everything is at the very least. I've lectured this kind of stuff now to practitioners, to postgraduates, and now, joy of joys, to undergraduates, for a long, long time now. And there's never been, actually, the higher profile the practitioners, the more they've been eager and resistant that I start at the very beginning. Assume we don't know anything. I used to run derivatives training courses years ago, and nobody knew what derivatives were, and it's all just starting up. Because I worked for, I don't know, anyone knows, I worked for Citibank for a while in the derivatives field, in the corporate finance field, long story. And I latterly worked for Goldman Sachs in the derivatives field, particularly as a lawyer covering the derivatives desk. And when I finally got out of the markets, I was able just then to write the first book. I thought, so someone needs to write all this down to help. If you weren't in the know, you weren't in one of those firms, you had no idea how this worked. And there really was an enormous amount, I thought, of big firms being able just to play corporate clients off who just didn't understand how these products work. So I wanted to write the first book, and everyone always wanted me to start at the very beginning. So my goal, it always seemed, was to explain the perimeter, to explain all the things you needed to know, at least to let you know where everything was that you needed to know about. So I'm hoping that as part of an education here, you'd be able to go off and start doing this, on the basis of knowing the course, as well as hopefully this being interesting as we go along. I must say, I find a lot of this fascinating. Websites towards the bottom, the blue bit, Finance Law Index, I think it's actually Finance Index, I have to put two files up there because I'm an idiot. You'll find all the materials on there. I'm going to put everything on Blackboard as soon as Blackboard works. Blackboard is the most intractable thing to try and put things on, so I much prefer doing it on my website. There's a big table there where I'm planning on doing lots and lots of podcasts, nice, easy, couple of minute introductory podcasts. To explain a lot of these topics to you. I'm going to put the lectures up after I've delivered the lectures as well, so if you want to go back to something, I'm sorry they're going to be an hour long blocks, but you can fast forward through those hopefully. If there's things you want on there, I'm going to do other short podcasts about further research, other ideas, links to other things as well. So there'll be a whole load of stuff on there on the site as we go through. what's in the book and what's also going on there is a glossary. Okay, so the back of the book has got a glossary that defines a lot of the terms we're going to use that might seem scary and novel to you now. Words like bond, what is that? What is a security? What is a share? The back of the book's got a glossary that tries to explain all of those things to you.
I'm going to put a longer glossary on the website soon. I'm also going to do a talking glossary, so you can just click on the podcast and in a minute or two I'll try and explain to you what I need to do. So hopefully that will help you in those kind of comprehension things. Books, we'll come back to books in a second. There are some introductory books, introductory reading, which might help. Because there's no doubt that it will help a lot to bring this to life if you understand how all this works. So on the bullet points, I think the most useful explanation of what the words mean is Michael Brett's How to Read the Financial Pages. So just get the most recent edition you can of that, I would suggest, from anywhere. There's loads of cheap ones on Amazon. I'm on at the library about getting things in there. I just don't know whether they have or not. I think information services is having trouble. Blackboard and everything else, the rollover hasn't gone well. It's good, isn't it, coming back, new term, building works still going on, Blackboard, not really. We changed its name, we managed that. So Michael Brett's book is very, very good. It was a very shocking, but very, very readable. It is aiming at people that are trying to work out, if I'm reading the Financial Times, what on earth does any of this mean? I always found it hugely readable. If you want books on how to explain how the city works, rather than explaining things word by word, like a dictionary, then Philip Coggins' book, I think, is very good. The Money Machine, How the City Works. 120, 130 pages, that kind of length. You know, with a kind of chapter on each of the main markets. And there's another one, William Clark, How the City of London Works, which Sweet and Maxwell publish. Again, I'm trying to get the library to get all of these, but these sort of things might be worth a look. There must be lots of these kind of books, I would think, in the management studies bit in the library as well, but I just haven't had a chance to go in there physically and look, I'm afraid. I will do. The dictionary that I refer to in the textbook when I want a dictionary definition of what a particular financial term means is Barron's Dictionary of Financial Investment Terms. I'm trying to get the library to get a copy of that as well. But I reproduce in the book all the key definitions that are needed. And so I'll bring bits of those along as well. But if that's the kind of thing you're interested in, you find a copy, why not? It's American, so the letter U doesn't appear very much. But it's fine other than that. Jolly good. So that's some general background reading. Of course, there's a huge literature on the financial crisis at the minute, which we'll look at in topic 11 in detail. The reason I put all the banking crisis stuff to the end is a lot will have changed, I'm assuming, by the time you get to the end of the course. So I thought if we leave it to the end, we can see what happens in the meantime. Okay? But we need to keep a watching brief on that. How do you keep a watching brief on things? Online materials. www.ft.com. Okay, you can get a free online subscription to ft.com, the Financial Times, but I don't see any reason not to do that. They only let you look at a given number of articles a month. I pay lots of money to get be able to get anything I want. But it might be, if you each take one, maybe you find an article you've got to be a little bit something else for yourself. Things that I find that I like, I'll stick on Blackboard for you. I'll talk to them a little bit about the copyright issues and that. But the FT is just brilliant. You will find the FT a bit dense and impenetrable when you start, but you'll start to see things coming round and round again. You'll start issues, and I'll talk about a lot of them as we go through. There will be illustrations of almost everything that we're going to talk about at some point in the FT. It's worth keeping up with. You can look at it online. There's always a copy lying around downstairs. You can buy it cheap as well on campus. You'll just be able to get it cheap. So whatever way suits you best, really. There are some great columnists in the FT as well. Very good. If you're thinking about writing essays, often very good at getting you into things. And the FT is a paper with footnotes. They do refer to official reports and academics pieces and whatever else. Gillian Tett, T-E-T-T, I recommend. She was the first one really to spot that the credit crunch was coming. She was writing about the credit crunch for so long beforehand. Why people kept saying, oh, no one saw this coming. Well, you just weren't reading Gillian, for God's sake. It was blindly obvious that something was going to cause it, and she'd spotted it was credit default swaps. She is very, very good. She usually writes in the second section, just inside the back page. She often has a column in there, or one of the feature columns elsewhere. She's a very nice woman. She's just published a book a little while ago. It's only in hardback at the minute. It's called Fool's Gold, which is a great discussion of where the crisis came from, which I'm going to suggest we read at some point. I'm hoping it's going to come out in paperback before you study it in March. Martin Wolf is very good. Martin Wolf is a great complainer and moaner, and very good economist.
Most newspapers have a reading age of 8. I don't know if you know this. People that study linguistics or whatever else, when you write in a newspaper, you're supposed to write for an 8-year-old to be able to understand it. Yeah? Or if it's the son, for someone that hasn't quite reached the reading age yet. It's still just interested in their mother's breast. Presumably that's how we explain the son. The FT has a slightly advanced reading age, but nevertheless, the articles just aren't impenetrable. You know, words you're not sure about, just keep going and you'll get the gist, or, you know, go look them up. The internet is brilliant, of course. You just plug a word in there and you'll find a definition online. So just stick with the FT, it'll be fine. What else is there? There's also the Wall Street Journal, online WSJ Wall Street Journal, now owned by Rupert Murdoch. It all used to be free and you could look at it online and stuff. Now you've got to pay for it. Because it's Murdoch, you know, you resent that slightly. There's also a specifically European version, European Wall Street Journal, Europe, WSJ. Again, with having a look, there's some stuff you can see online, but a lot of it they want you to pay for it as soon as you click on anything. Other sites you want to get on your browser or get the hang of, the regulatory rule book is fsa.gov.uk. The Financial Services Authority is the financial regulator in the UK, and all the regulations we're going to talk about, we talk about financial regulation, pretty much, are in the FSA handbook. So that's a website you need to find your way around as well. Most of that stuff you just can't find in hard copy. You have to do it online anyway. The Economist is very good, I think. Weekly paper, which, again, you can get cheap if you're so minded, or there's a load of you living in a house together and you want to get a cheap subscription between you. Again, you can get very cheap student subscriptions. They're trying to get you involved in that, aren't they, for life. There's a short section in there, Finance and Economics, which has got finance stories, which has been brilliant over the last year or so, obviously with the crisis going on. Otherwise, any quality newspaper would help with business and financial stuff, but there's nothing quite like the FT. I sound like I'm selling it, don't I? The New York Times is also very good. Where's that bullet point gone there? Oddly, Vanity Fair. I don't know why I'm standing here recommending Vanity Fair. But Vanity Fair has some really good stuff by Niall Ferguson, professor at NYU, professor of history that's taken to writing about economics a lot recently. His book, The Ascent of Money, is fine. It's a bit journalisty at times for a professor, frankly. It says sniffily, but there you go. They've also had people like Joseph Stiglitz, the Nobel Prize-winning economist, writing in there, Paul Krugman, the Nobel Prize-winning economist as well. So Vanity Fair, oddly, and a lot of it's free. Bless you. So we're making some of that available on WebCT Blackboard as we go along. But oddly, Vanity Fair really hasn't been bad. They're trying to make themselves seem serious. Mm. Buy some luggage. Oh, and here's a crisis.
Yes, yeah, very good.
Jolly good. There are lots of journals, obviously, in the library. Some that are interesting for this particular area. And again, look for what interests you. There's a Journal of International Banking Law and Regulation, or JIBLA. It used to be called Jubal in the old days, and then they put regulation on as well. That's not bad. That tends to be practitioners writing 500 words on whatever. Okay, so it's not heavy duty like Law Quarterly Review or Modern Law Review. You know, I've put lots of things in there. In fact, I owe them about 3 things already for this year. The company law is very good for company law, but that also covers a lot of finance as well. How many of us are doing company law out of interest? Exciting. Jolly good, okay. Commonality logic. No company laws ever here.
What are we all doing over here? Human rights, public international, labelling, commercial.
We're all going commercial here. Company law over here.
Yeah.
There must be a reason why. Fine. Jolly good. Well, the company law you'd be looking at a lot of company lawyers anyway. There's a huge crossover between shares, the issue of shares, and all that kind of stuff, and finance now. And it's fun, actually, how many company lawyers try to ignore all the European directives still. Yes, some of the textbooks, in fact, don't even mention them. There we are. So there's a whole array of stuff out there. What else is there for you to read? Well, the textbook, Vaingloriously, is mine. It was written. It was written for you, Doug. It's good to be back amongst friends. Can I just say that? Hello.
It's good to see you.
I didn't think I'd be saying that when I got out of bed this morning.
Oh, God.
So it was written for you, that's the plan. Are there other textbooks? Well, there's Philip Wood's The Law of Practice, The Law and Practice of International Finance, University Edition. Philip was one of the senior partners at Allen & Overy, and he sort of ran the banking and finance area, and is a very nice man. He's a visiting professor here, Oxford and Cambridge, and he spends his life wandering around talking to people there. that's what happens when you're eminent. He writes for practitioners a 7-volume Law of International Finance, and he's produced a student edition, which is basically just copy and pasting out of the 7-volume thing. It is, word for word, copy and paste. It might be fun to look at simply to see how little law there is in it. Philip's approach is the approach of a practitioner. This is how we do this in the market. And then a bullet-pointed list of these are the types of things we need in the contract. And case law and the kind of history of law just isn't nearly as important. Now, Philip is a very good lawyer. I'm not denigrating his legal skills for one second. But what's fascinating is his approach to finance was just, this is what we do in the market. This is how we do it. So we're going to talk a lot about standard market contracts, a lot of websites for these trade associations. You can find all this stuff online, we'll do all that. But that's entirely Philip's focus. So it's a very good book for your purposes, for telling you how the products work. I mean, I hope I've done a job of that as well. But it's interesting that that's another way of doing finance, which is pretending there's no law at all. Fascinating. Another, Jeff Golden, who's another partner at A&A, very senior partner at A&A, lovely man, I've known Jeff for a long, long time. He was, as he says, in the room when they created the Derivatives Trade Association years ago. He was in the room when they picked the name, he always says. He was arguing a little while ago that actually we should have some judges now who are people like him who are finance professionals. You don't need people that know about law, he reckons. You need people that know about how finance works, and they should be judges. Actually, look out the window. Have you not noticed things going on? But it's interesting, there are this kind of group of finance lawyers that they have their own private knowledge. So a lot of what I'm trying to do with this course is to explode the privacy of that knowledge. Yeah? We all come to know about it, we all get to think about it and critique and whatever else. But Philip's book is fascinating. It's kind of an insider's approach. This is how we do it. When he talks about Hunter and Moss, for example, he spends a sentence on Hunter and Moss. No mention of Goldcorp, no mention of McDonald Brown, any of those other cases. The assumption is Hunter and Moss is a good case, let's just do what we want, let's forget anything else. And it's fascinating how finance lawyers can just say, no, no, blah, 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 not listening, da, la, 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 and just carry on. And that's why we ended up in the trouble we are now. It's exactly that, don't care, not looking, can't hear, not interested. So it's fascinating how this does operate as what philosophers would call them, what Richard Nobles would call an autopoietically closed universe, yes? You know, we're just our own little bubble, we're not interested in everybody else. We'll take things we like from other bits of the world and just ignore the rest. Eating systems theory with Richard at some point. We'll talk about all that. Fun. So that's Philip Wood's book. It's in paperback, you know, vaguely affordable, 50 quid or something. Again, I hope they're getting that in the library. Ellinger and Omnishka have got a new version of Modern Banking Law. It's shorter than my book and doesn't go into the finance stuff. It really focuses on banking more than mine does. So, but that's there as well. Ross Cranston now, Mr. Justice Cranston. Eva Mishka taught me Kings years ago. Lovely. But Eva likes me telling people that she interviewed me as an undergraduate for the press. She thinks it makes her sound old. Ross Cranston now, High Court Judge. Again, lovely man. His Principles of Banking Law. I think hopefully he's trying to bring out a new edition despite his caseload. Cranston is very good. It's very short. And there's a way of writing about finance that a lot of finance lawyers like to do, which is just talk about the various committees that decide things, the way in which markets have produced things, and again, to talk not much law, but to talk at a very kind of generalist level. Ross's book is excellent, very elegantly written. It's 400 or 500 pages long. You can find that in the library as well. You find our library has a lot of finance books in, because they're there for the LLM students, so you get to go and pillage all that stuff. Yeah, that'd be sound. Brilliant. We're the only ones that live at Mile End, we might as well use the stuff. There's a whole load of all this stuff should be in there as a result. So you'll find Philip's 7-volume thing as well as the 1-volume thing. Case of materials books, sorry, there just aren't any. Which tends to be trying to give you so much stuff in the materials. And then what other practitioner stuff is there? Well, there's all kinds of stuff. There are two big encyclopedias, loose leaves. There's the banking law encyclopedia that Butterworths do. Which only really covers a part of what we're doing on this course, or modules, as we know. But very good for what it is. They're very antique. They used to, in their section on securities, which any banker would now think means bonds and shares and all those things you trade on exchanges, they had securities as just the old law on mortgages. It's really old, quite quaint. Bless. They've updated a little bit now. Financial Services Law Encyclopedia does the Financial Services and Markets Act section by section. Rather than being a text, it's just annotated statutes. They're very good if you're talking about a particular provision. Look things up in that.
I don't know whether we've got it on the college's LexisNexis or Westlaw package, I really don't know. But you can look, Eva Lomnischka is responsible for that, and she's very, very good section by section. Otherwise, I've written a slew of things on finance, book on securities law, book on financial derivatives, book on investment entities, and a big slug of Palmer's company law on securities regulation. There's a brilliant book by Andrew McKnight called The Law of International Finance, which is a huge fat thing, costs 250 quid, which is what mine will be in hardback. I mean, who pays this kind of money? Anyway, very good, Andrew. Andrew's worked for Salons for a very long time and taught on the LLM here for decades. So that was just new out last year. Blair and Walker edits a collection of essays, really, called Financial Services Law, which has come out in OUP just this year in the new edition, and also something called Financial Markets and Exchanges Law. So again, interesting perspectives there as well. So there's lots of practitioner stuff. We're just trying to move it higher up the food chain to you, basically. Because I said higher up the food chain, not lower down. That's what I like. So written work, all the things you'd expect, you know, an essay a term, it's all in the seminar material. Magda and I will do all of that. Brilliant. You'll find my usual timetable of lectures set out in a nice colourful box. So this was to begin at the beginning today. We're going to start into financial regulation tomorrow. And I'll talk about that in a second. I know we're at time. So that will tell you what we're going to do lecture by lecture. So this is where we're supposed to start. So I'm actually going to start with this tomorrow and just try and hurry. I don't know why my podcast don't work. I must have put them up badly and broken the link, so apologies. That will cover a lot of the stuff that I intended to cover today if you had handouts. What will we do about handouts? Apparently a lot of them are in G6 already copied. We have a lecture at 11 tomorrow, if I remember my timetable right. How many of us have actually got a handout at all? Has anyone got one? So absolutely no one's got one. Genius. In paper, or have you just downloaded it? Downloaded it, brilliant, good for you. Anyone that can download, download. Otherwise, if you assemble before, have you got things before the lecture tomorrow morning? Some of you, I'm going to talk about seminars, so thank you, Ben. I'm going to talk about seminars in just a second. I'll stand with them.
Excuse me to interrupt you. I've got a lot of students who think there's a class here now.
Okay, with.